gotta thank you for yourself, Buc-ee's, for 48 years, Tom. 48 years. Thank you for that yesterday, Andrew. On Friday, they've been servicing your car with all the needs that you have. Whether it's brakes are squeaky or maybe your alignment is out of whack, take the car there to Buc-ee's, Buc-ee's Auto Service Center for 48 years, doing great work. All right. Exciting weekend for me, Tom. I was in Tacoma at St. Charles Auction both Friday and Saturday night.
They do a double dose
auction?
Double
dose of auction.
Wow.
They really grinded out of their parents there. One guy who had more than enough alcoholic beverages came up to me and said, I will pay $2,500 if you and Jory come to my house and have dinner. So I don't have Dory's phone number.
Uh-huh. But you committed to it anyway.
I didn't. Now, that's the new me, because the old me would have committed immediately. But then I thought, Dory is not the kind of person necessarily wants to go to somebody's house in Tacoma. And Dory, did I get it
You're
right?
You're correct.
Okay, good. Fine. Because I could have committed him, and then he would have been so mad at me and never talked to me again. So I just said, you know, I don't think Dory, I don't know. So I text Nicole, his producer. But you're right. He would not do that, right, Ursula? He's sort of shy when it comes to that stuff.
He is shy, surprisingly.
Okay, got it. Thank
That's one word for it.
No, Tom. It is an interesting, dichotomy between the Dory on the air and then the Dory, the shy guy that's always walking around real meek and like he's
Wait. I wouldn't agree with meek. No. But he's just
me.
A little more pop. Get out.
He's flinching. All right, here we go. Let's get to the news. Investigators using DNA in order to track down a suspect that was, they believed, involved in a double homicide back in 1987. So this sounds like we're repeating a story we told you 4 weeks ago about the Golden Gate, Golden State
killer.
Same deal. They got DNA. They were able to get the guy's DNA, and then they had the DNA that was the crime scene. And then they went to one of those genealogy websites, and they were able to then extract, find some other DNA that was similar to that killer and then track the guy down. So it's like catching him through the back door.
So one of these genealogy sites that a lot of us abuse, Ancestry.com and 23andMe, they do not release this information. But once you get the information, so John, if you had gone to 23andMe and got your information, then you can post it on another website.
Uh-huh.
And it's that website that the police are using now, apparently across the country, at least here in Washington State and California at least, and they can start testing their DNA swabs with anybody in this category. So if you feel like, oh, suddenly my DNA is now public to the world, no. You have to post it to this other particular website. But there are enough people that do that it's allowed for, at least in the accusation stage, the charging stages, to nab two killers who killed 30 years ago.
So the interesting thing is people go, well, why would a killer put his DNA up?
Yes.
The killer didn't do it.
No.
The killer doesn't do it. His, what, second cousin removed or somebody put it up there, right?
What they did is they, if it's anybody in that shares your DNA, and so that can go back generations upon generations, you have second cousins of second cousins, and what they do is they can recreate a reverse genealogical family tree.
Yes.
And then out of that, they say, okay, now let's say we've generated 64 names that are people related to this that have this connection to what we think is the DNA from the crime scene.
Mm-hmm.
They'll say, well, so let's, through process of elimination, okay, well, that person's been dead for 20 years and this person, but what they end up zeroing in, they can just sort of pencil, you know, off or out the people that don't fit the profile or couldn't have been in that situation. And then it leaves them with, say, two or three people that might be considered suspects that might have had that DNA that would have been the right age and in the geographical area at the time. And after, at that point, they can actually start, if you get a warrant, you can start following them and seeing if you can capture their DNA.
Here's a question for you. How would you feel if the government were to capture everyone's DNA upon birth? And it goes into a database.
Well, I think that it depends on how.
Money saving, time saving.
It is, absolutely. And it's true. I mean, we all have Social Security numbers. We are identifiable. It depends on if you trust your government. If you think that this could get into the wrong hands. And
let's remember, we are the government.
We are the government.
Right.
That's
we're the
right.
ones that release the dogs in Birmingham, Alabama. We're the ones that round up the Japanese.
Well,
right? Yeah. We are the government.
We are the government, and
that's
we
right.
can correct ourselves. But the problem is that the government was taken over by the wrong forces.
Oh, like Trump?
Well, I mean, I think there are enough checks and balances that Trump doesn't really scare me. But the idea is that if suddenly this government became very big brother, very fascist, all these kinds of things.
But I thought we are the government.
We are the government. Okay. We have to be on guard to let go, make sure that we do not give up our rights.
Okay.
I mean,
so we're
listen,
only the government.
Hitler was democratically elected,
yes,
and then he ended up taking over the government, so no elections were allowed for it. Those are the kind of dangers. If you thought a Hitler kind of person would come in and have now access to all your DNA, and then you decide, you know, anybody with Irish descent, they're lesser people. We're going to wipe them out, or we're going to not allow them to go to school or something. That could be a concern.
I see.
Short of those kind of nightmare scenarios. I don't know that I would have a huge problem with it.
Got it. Yeah, because if you believe we are the government and Hitler was elected democratically, then the Jews killed themselves through suicide because they're part of the government. So the idea of the DNA, I wouldn't mind if the government collected everybody's DNA.
You wouldn't, huh?
No.
So you're not a privacy issue. I mean, you never have been, as long as we've done the show.
No, go ahead. I got nothing to hide.
But you're suspicious of the government usually.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm surprised that you would not be concerned.
What would they do with it?
Well,
they would now
I could
could track me down if I were to suddenly disappear. My DNA would be present. Yeah. It'd be so much more efficient. See, I don't look at the amount of money that's spent and the amount of heartache that goes into when these crimes occur and years and money spent and the time and the manpower to track these things down. If they had everybody's DNA when you came into the world, they just simple little sample right there, put into a database. And then you could be able to use that DNA for maybe breakthroughs when it comes to science. You would also be able to use it if some sort of crime were to occur. And it would just be a way of sort of keeping track of people. That's all.
That's true. But let's say that there is a government that was so liberal that they decided that they were suspicious of libertarians.
Uh-huh.
And they used your DNA to help track you down when you were saying, I was just expressing my right as a citizen to protest. He says, no, I know you did. We just want to bring
you in
for a few
questions. You
mean like
on a college campus where I can't express my point of view?
Wherever you want, John. But the idea is that the concern would be, and I'm just, this is just devil's advocate kind of thing.
I got it.
The concern would be that they would be able then to track you down. Any kind of authority could track you down, or not if it got in the wrong hands. But I mean, said, okay, listen, there's something about you. We saw you at a particular protest, and they would be able to track you down through whatever scientific
and
means.
What crime did I commit?
Well, the thing is, as you find out in this country, people are convicted or beat up or killed for crimes they didn't commit necessarily, but because they were of the wrong political persuasion or the wrong color or whatever. So, I mean, it's this idea of positions of authority. Could they abuse it? Well, yes, they could abuse it.
Yeah.
How much of a concern that is. But, yeah, if we can agree on that, it just becomes like anybody's ID, your fingerprints.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll go for it, John.
Good.
We'll take a risk against the future.
How about this? This big article that was in the Seattle Times over the weekend talking about SDOT, right? Seattle Department of Transportation.
Okay. So you're not going to play any of these clips?
We covered
it,
right?
Okay, good enough.
Okay, good. So the piece in the Times basically lays out the trouble that SDOT has been having for ever since they came up with that big $900 million.
Yeah, basically, it was a big summary of all
of their
last
failures.
Decade, yeah.
And where the money's being spent and how come they can't deliver on time and why it's over budget and why it's not delivered and why they continue to make it smaller and smaller and smaller. I thought some of the interesting stuff was I didn't know they hired a consultant for $250,000 to teach the executives how to do better about communicating. And then they spent another $500,000 on some other project as well.
Well, yeah, but that was after. I mean, the thing is, that's to kind of clean up the mess they'd already made.
Yes.
They realize, what the heck's going on here? And so they hire people to say, hey, you got to get – we need to get back on track here. And so they hired consultants to get us
leadership
back on
coaching
track.
Back in 2016, plus the city paid $400,000.
Yeah, back in 2016. That's only 2 years ago. That's the thing is it was these problems have been happening, you know, long before that.
And then they hired consultants from KPMG to review the troubled streetcar project. That cost $400,000. Here's the big question I have on all these programs. Is SDOT – intentionally deceiving the city council with inflated numbers of either ridership or decreasing the cost and then the delivery time? Are they giving them bad information for them to vote for these programs, knowing full well that they can't possibly get them done in time and at that budget? Are they deceiving the city council?
Well, there's a lot of suspicion. Here's, as we well know, just about anything, you can always do a spin. And so what you do is if you have a range, you can focus on the lower end of the range if it's terms of prices and the higher end of the range in terms of promises. now, there's a long article in today's Seattle Times summarizing that. How can a bike path actually cost $12 million a ride? Yeah. And they go through the entire thing, and they talk to somebody who's no longer with the city, but is now the head of transportation, I think, in Toronto, who used to be with SDOT. And her surmise is, no. It's just, this is how they figured things out. She didn't think it was anything intentional, mm-hmm. The way they did it, but there were all these unforeseen factors, and they said, yes. What she says, the idea is that once you build one bike path, then you learn from the mistakes of that. Okay, here's how we could mitigate costs. Mm-hmm. And she points out in this article that, for instance, the drainage, people hadn't calculated drainage is responsible for like 50% of the cost. Mm-hmm. And they said, we've got to figure out a way so we don't have to affect drains and all this kind of stuff, that we can get better. But this is one of the first times we had done it. Now, if you are, like Dory, I think, and maybe like you, you immediately are suspicious that there's kind of like a bad intent,
yeah.
that people are lying as opposed to just not knowing, not being on top of it enough. It's certainly open to debate. I completely see that.
I would love to see somebody find if they are deceiving. There must be some evidence of an email back and forth. Somebody has something that says, listen, tell them this number as opposed to that number. If you'd like your plan, your health plan, you can keep it. Same thing. They did deliberately deceive people.
Got a lot more examples of Trump.
I'm just taking a classic one that really hit the economy. deceptive, intentionally knowing that is not true, but in order to get it passed, you tell people that. That's all.
Okay, so we had this classic debate. This is about the streetcar, right?
Yeah.
That, between King County Metro and SDOT. SDOT argues one thing. King County Metro, who's going to have to operate that, says, no, it'll cost this much. SDOT says that. Can you have a disagreement over numbers, or do you have to impugn the motives of one of the two sides?
Well, if a person has a history, or the organization, and let's say it's the SDOT folks, have a clear, distinct, identifiable pattern of giving you one number and then finding out, shock and awe, that it actually costs more. And then they give you a number and you find it costs more. And then they tell you, oh, ridership's going to be at $35,000 and it's barely $7,000. It's like, wow, it looks like there's a pattern in here. If they're not trying to deceive, then they're incredibly incompetent.
Or thing that what they do is, if you can explain why it went from X amount to Y amount over these, the next 12 months. I mean, it's explain it. Here's what happened. Mm-hmm. That long explanation in the Seattle Times about this $12 million a mile bike lane cost, they explained a lot about how these kinds of things happen. Traffic, they decided to put in traffic signals at the same time. Mm-hmm. I mean, you just see all the costs. The cost of putting the bike path in there is one-tenth of what it costs to put the bike path in there, uh-huh. if you just focus on that. And so I think that people can make financial miscalculations in good cause.
Oh, I see.
In just sort of a effort.
Right. But it'd be nice to actually have them get one of these right one time. That would make news.
I think that's definitely the case.
SDOT actually brings something in under budget and in time.
Well, they did. They have put in bike paths that actually were under budget from what they had promised as well. The idea is they were going for an average. And here's another interesting thing. Well, that's a little wrinkle, then we can move on.
Make it interesting.
Durkin has a whole new SDOT. She got rid of Kubli and put in a whole new SDOT people, and they're the ones, they're interim right now. They're the ones saying, they look back at the work that had been handled in the earlier administration and said, yeah, this is out of whack. This is how we're going to adjust it. And so for that point of view, maybe we can look forward to an SDOT that's more responsive than the Ed Murray administration was.
Speaking of transportation, I did one of those Lime bikes yesterday.
Oh, you did? What do you mean one? I mean, just
another
one.
Got on one.
Not an electric one.
Yeah, electric one.
Oh, an electric one.
I did
one.
Electric one.
Oh, okay.
It's nice.
It is. Huh?
It helps you get going. You put your foot down. It gives you like a little bit of zip.
Okay.
So it zips you along pretty well.
Do you stop pedaling? Did you not pedal just to
No, I kept pedaling.
You did kept pedaling. Okay.
You got to keep pedaling.
Okay, you do.
So I parked the thing out in front of the restaurant I want to go to, and I walk away, forgetting to close it and unlock it. I mean, close it and lock it.
Okay.
So now what happens? I'm
so
still getting charged. Yes.
Oh, my God. Oh.
Somebody gets it. Because I run back to where it was, and I'm like, oh, it must be around here. But there's only like 600 of these bikes. So I'm like looking around like, where's mine?
You need to put a little curly sticker on it so you can identify.
It was unlocked, so the person rides away. And you get charged like 15 cents a minute and like certain such a mile. I'm like, well, this bike, this person could take this bike forever.
It's on your dime.
On that dime. So you end up riding to e-bike or to Lime Bike, telling them exactly what happened. And they say, oh, we're very sorry about that. and they took the whole thing off. They gave me a refund on all of it.
Wow.
Yeah. And they said, okay, fine. Because I was trying to lock it remotely, but you can't.
Yeah.
You have to close the thing back down again. So that's, I think a lot of people forget that they have to do that, especially if you do it for the first time.
Yeah.
But you need to relock it again. That's why I think most of them end up at these homeless shelters or in these S shacks. They got a lot of bikes around these tents because they must be unlocked. There's no way. These guys also have cell phones that have credit cards attached to it.
That's not true, John. I mean, there are.
You're living in a tent?
Well, the thing is, a lot of people, we've talked about that. There are a lot of people that have jobs. They don't pay enough, but they have jobs, so they actually have some money. So it doesn't seem that expensive to probably take a bike. It's probably cheaper, especially if they use it to get to work.
I'm telling you, we still need to go on our field trip.
Okay.
All right? We'll go on a field trip. Andrew, you can drive.
Oh, great.
Okay. And take us. Thank you. And we'll bring Andrew
with
us.
He won't commit Dory, but he will commit you to.
No, seriously. Yeah. Andrew drives. You and I go in the sit in the back, and we'll go down to one of, you pick it, wherever you want to go, whatever homeless, tent camp, encampment you want to go to,
okay.
And we can talk to the people and get some facts.
Let's go to one in the Bay Area.
We drive it down there, Andrew?
I don't have a pilot's license.
No. You drive.
Tom, oh, yeah, that's
Tom,
a lot
and I'd be in the back seat talking the whole time.
Yeah.
9 hours. All right, let's see. We're going to get Mariners tickets. We're going to be giving those away. And
they are doing unbelievably well, considering they don't have Cano.
And we're going to get to advice for grads. Often, especially around this time of year, you get a lot of inspiring commencement speakers telling kids to go for it and change the world and make dreams come true and give back, give back, give back, give back. Some advice from the Wall Street Journal they put forward that you don't do that. What you really need to do is get yourself a boring job. We'll be right back.
A Wall Street Journal of them.
Here we go. Write to us at MyNorthWest.com. Text as well at 98973. We do appreciate all of those that listen to the Tom Curley Show to make this. I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but more listeners than Dory, I think, or at least higher in the ratings. And he is still steaming mad in his own little steaming mad way.
He's so mad he took Friday off. I guess he's not really that scared of us.
Well, he said he cursed
his daughter got married. Let me just be here to.
He cursed his vacation. He did. He cursed his vacation.
But congratulations on the great ratings.
Thank you, Ursula. All right. Congratulations on the listeners of the Tom and Curley Show. A lot of them in Tacoma. Again, not many fans of yours in Tacoma, Tom. But a lot of folks there listening to the show. Thank you, everybody, for tuning
in. That's right. You were just dissing Tacoma last segment.
I remember that. Was I? What was I saying about Tacoma last segment? I don't think so. Okay. That might have been off the air.
No, not off the air.
What did I say about Tacoma? That's not true. Love
you
the T-Town.
You said that you didn't think that Dory would like to go have dinner with somebody in Tacoma.
No.
You
You're adding
that
no,
up. No.
No,
you
no.
said it.
Hold on, Andrew. I said.
Go to the videotape.
Hold on. I didn't say in Tacoma.
It had nothing to do with Tacoma. He was just talking about generally Dory being shy.
Yeah, that's right. And not wanting to go to dinner in Tacoma. And I thought, that's odd. Why would you add that phrase in Tacoma like that was a qualifier?
You were the one that reading into it. You know what? Everybody that dislikes Sam, you have every reason to dislike him because he dislikes you. Often you'll have the college commencement speeches given, and it's somebody standing up there that is going to be far more successful than you'll ever be. And they're telling you to follow your dreams and give back and make the world a better place. And then if you were to do a quick survey, which is done in the Wall Street Journal, what percentage of college graduates say they want to make the world a better place, Tom?
44% of millennials, at least,
yes.
Think that they want to do that. They want to do more to support social causes, mm-hmm. and that's their goal in life, is to be a better person and make the planet a better planet.
Yes. Now, if you have incredible intellect, or your parents have spent $250,000 on you to have this great brain, and you could possibly do something with it. One thing, you could be digging latrines in Honduras, or you could use that great brain to be actually sitting behind a desk and doing a boring job. You'll do more for society at the desk than you will over a shovel.
It depends on what the boring job is, but you're right. His suggestion is something he calls scale, and the idea is that we all feel better. In fact, you've done a lot of this, John. I thought you might have some quibble with his argument that, you know, you can go down and help at a food bank or a homeless shelter. Mm-hmm. Or they said you could even, you know, be out in the field, you know, with your hoe if you want to.
Yeah.
And he says, and you'll help you know, a handful of people, seven or eight people, maybe 30, 40 people, whoever you're helping, that's one thing, and that's all good and all, and you may feel good about yourself, and you did help those individuals. But if you really wanted to be more effective, it would be better if you sat behind a desk, for instance, and figured out a way to help these people in a broader scale, so you could impact not 40 people, but 4,000 people, or 40,000 people, or maybe 4 million if you came up with an idea or a way to help facilitate, a distribution system, for instance.
Yes. So if you if you're capable of more than just a strong back,
right? Yes.
Then you should be doing something else. Dave the cop said to me, "Why are you washing dishes at a homeless shelter?"
Yes. Yeah, that's good.
And I realize this is not the best use of my God-given skills.
Yes.
Yes, I'm really good on pots with baked-on cheese.
That's not what I heard.
Okay, you know, it's always up for debate.
Yeah, that's right. But more soap.
The thing is, they keep hide the good scrubby brush. People hide the good ones.
No, you're with your pen knife.
Like, we had a better one. Oh, yeah, Gary normally hides the good ones. Like, where's Gary? All right.
Okay,
So Dave says, yes. What are you doing? He says, you have the ability to communicate. You have the ability to tell stories. You've got the ability to listen sometimes.
Yeah.
You should use that skill, not the skill of cleaning pots and pans.
Right.
So I'm not working in Union Gospel Mission anymore.
You're moved on
to St. Vincent de Paul, and I'm going to be working the hotline.
Okay.
So on the hotline, I'm going to be an empathetic listener. I'm going to help solve problems. So that's a better use of my skills and still give something back.
I think this makes a lot of sense. Now, one of the things that he points out in this article, and I also want to ask you about this because you do a lot of this kind of volunteer work.
It makes me feel good.
You can hoe and sickle grow rutabagas to feed a few hungry folks. But then it's really all about you.
It is.
Absolutely. But the deal is that you could make that same argument about being the Peace Corps. I mean, a lot of the, you know, bright college graduates go to the Peace Corps and they're doing a lot of grunt work. Mm-hmm. And yet I would argue, not that this guy doesn't have a good point, but I think there is value, even if it's on a personal level, for you to, you know, muck about in the real world, in the physical world, and deal face-to-face with people in addition to, you know, your behind-the-desk job being brilliant, coming up with some kind of micro-loan technology that allows the, you know, the poorest countries in the world to, you know, alleviate malnutrition.
Right.
Isn't there a value on the personal level for you? I mean, like, you end up meeting the homeless people that you're helping and getting a better perspective and sense. Isn't that okay to feel good about yourself for doing that? Because you're feeling good about yourself because you're contacting with people you normally wouldn't have.
Challenging your altruism? I remember I interviewed Penn and Teller once, and I remember mentioning Mother Teresa to one of them. And who's the guy with the ponytail? Is that Penn or Teller? That's Teller, right?
No, I think that's Penn.
It's a Penn. That's Penn, right.
Yeah, Penn Jillette.
And he said something horrible about Mother Teresa.
Yes.
And then he said, you think Mother Teresa's doing that for the poor people? Yeah. Mother Teresa's doing that for herself. I was like, wow, that's harsh. That's really harsh. He goes, anytime you do something nice for somebody, you're doing it for yourself. So the idea is that I do those things because it makes me feel better.
That's right.
Right.
But I think for you to feel better, why do you feel better? I think it's because you are doing it, maybe on a one-to-one scale, but I can imagine somebody who just sits behind a desk and figures out some kind of brilliant technology to feed the poor.
Right.
But he still has no personal, you know, connection with people. In other words, I think it's good to try to do both, that we should have personal connections and we should have brilliant intellectual ideas that save the world.
So the balance of the individual one who's sitting behind the desk or sitting behind the microscope, and then in order to have a better understanding of the work that's being done, maybe every couple of months you go to inspire yourself to see the face of those that you will be changing, and then you come back and maybe that's the thing that gives you the medal or the inspiration in order to keep going.
Yes. Okay. So that's not to mitigate. I mean, I think this guy raises an interesting point. Yeah, rather than somehow we have this idea that if we're out, you know, in the fields, you know, backbreaking work, that somehow we're a better person for it. Well, you might be a better person for it, but you'd be more effective. The world would be better off if you did something more theoretical that helped more people. It's a bit like Bill Gates when President Trump offered him a science advisor. Do you want to be a science advisor? And he says, no, it'd be a waste of my time.
Mm-hmm.
Because a science advisor, I mean, he has much more impact as Bill Gates and his foundation working on that than just being the advisor to the president.
How many people are still doing Peace Corps? That was pretty popular in the 60s. Is it still?
I think it's still going strong. I mean, you keep hearing about it. But, yeah, we could check in the more recent numbers. But it's still existing. I don't know if it's thriving.
Word to Gary. I found the good scrubby brush, by the way, and I hit it. I just want to let you say that was like 3 weeks ago. So working your phone.
But you're, at one auction, you can raise money to buy 500 of those good scrubby brushes.
Yes, but then Gary, that just gives him more to hide. Okay. The Staten Island man that found the this in his backyard, and then things got really weird for him, Tom. And made a lot of news out of it. Plus, we'll get to some other news as well you got to get to, including the fact that the Republican Party now has somebody to run against Maria Cantwell. How about that, huh?
It's a familiar face.
Fun and interesting story. How about the teen that impersonates the cop? And then what he does next, his mother gets so upset she turns him in. We'll come right back to Tom and Curly Show right here on Cairo Radio. Tickets, we got to get away to the Mariners game. When are we doing that, Andrew?
11:15-ish.
11:15-ish? Okay. All right. It's going to be easy to win, too. We'll just take the first, what are we going to do? First five callers?
132nd.
132nd. Make it a little bit harder for you. You'll have to say, Domino's Pizza, how can I help you? All righty. Let's see the last couple stories to get to here before we kiss off the 1047 segment. Staten Island man, Tom, finds something in his backyard.
I like this story.
Me too.
There are all sorts of interesting wrinkles.
But at the end, do you feel a little sorry for him?
No.
You don't?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I feel satisfied.
Oh, you do?
I do.
You do. Okay, here we go.
You dream as a kid that, you know, you find a buried treasure. And it happened. It was unbelievable.
When you find treasure, you open it. And that's what they did.
Hundreds and jewelry, diamonds, engagement ring, dozens of rings, gold with jade. It was stunning.
4 years in the Woodell Avenue home, and the couple never knew there were thousands upon thousands of dollars, smelly, soaking wet, and stuck together, just rotting in their yard.
I just kept on peeling more, more hundreds, and more hundreds, and more hundreds.
In the safe, another discovery, a paper with an address which they linked to their neighbors.
First, I knocked on the door, and I asked them if they were ever robbed, and they said they were.
The NYPD says a burglary was reported at that home in 2011, a safe missing with about $52,000 worth of property.
What was their reaction? I mean, this is years without all of this money.
Well, she was shaking.
And they were told, the cops told her, you'll never see your stuff again.
Those neighbors didn't want to go on camera, but say they're surprised and grateful.
A couple people have said to us, why did you return it? But it wasn't even a question. It wasn't ours.
This elephant now sits where the safe once was, and the couple says it'll always serve as a reminder of their incredible discovery.
So did you get a reward?
Did you get a reward?
No.
Just answer.
I was guessing. I thought you wanted me.
No.
Not yet. I guess the reward is karma. Good karma.
There you go. Okay, so how did the safe get in the backyard in the first place? So it was stolen from the previous residents and then buried in their own backyard?
Yes. So there are all these interesting wrinkles about it. First off, these people that bought the house and the property from 4 years ago.
Okay.
It had been there for 7 years, I guess, the safe. But it was just a box that was in the backyard garden. They just sort of said they figured it was an old electrical box. It was just part of the property. So they didn't even look at it. They didn't even do anything with it. They didn't dig it up. They didn't say, what is this? They just left it there for 4 years until they had deer came in and they ate up all the vegetation around there and said, oh, we're going to need to plant new things.
Okay.
And so at that point, a landscaper said, hey, this thing is in the way. And they dug it up. And they go, oh, my God, it's a safe. And they figured out how to crack it open. So just the idea that you have something in your backyard, you don't even bother to investigate it because you're busy with your life.
Sure.
That to me is the first interesting wrinkle. The other odd thing is, they said it weighed between 80 and 100 pounds. Here's a guy, so they now have caught the guy who was known as the, some kind of a, they had some kind of name for him. I forget now what it was, but let me go look this up. What's his, the ninja burglar.
Okay.
So the ninja burglar for 10 years had been hassling this particular one of a number of neighborhoods in this Tilt neighborhood area. But he apparently didn't just steal things. He stole a 100-pound safe. Can you imagine carrying him around? So he only made it around the block.
Yeah,
he got too heavy.
I can.
And then he dumped it in somebody's backyard.
Okay, so he steals it, and then he walks with it for a little bit, and then he dumps it.
Then dumps it in somebody's backyard and figures, well, I'll come back and get it later,
probably
maybe,
nothing in there anyway.
And then they had all that money in there. But no, the funny thing is then, why did you turn it over? The guy admits in the article that's printed in the Seattle Times, the guy says, I was going to keep it. I wasn't going to tell police. I was going to keep it. Uh-huh. But then once I realized that I knew who the owners might have been, then I have to turn it over. And so that's why that he had already made that calculation. Okay, well, gee, you know, I just found $52,000 worth of stuff. I don't know whose it is. I'm just going to keep it. That seems like a human instinct that, that people can relate to. I'd be freaked out that somebody's going to come hunting
for
it.
So if he didn't know the previous owners, then he would have kept it.
And it wasn't even the previous owners. He said there was a little address inside the safe.
So it was two owners before, I think, right? Was it
Well, no. It was the people that had it were
down the street.
Down the street where the guy robbed it and then just dumped the safe in somebody else's backyard.
Notice the question he asked. Was your house ever broken into? And the response, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you don't think he ever verified.
You don't believe that's theirs?
I wouldn't buy it for a second.
Okay.
Oh, really?
Enough plausible deniability for me to keep it.
I see. No.
I would say in a husband-wife situation, if they're both sitting there, they find it, they're sitting on the couch determining, hey, what do we do? What do we do? Mm-hmm. If the wife had said, let's keep it, mm-hmm. I wonder if the guy would have been like, you know, I'm not going to go against her on that one. They both were probably in agreement that you turn it in. That's just the right thing to do.
But it was only turned in not to the police. What I think the right thing to do would be, hey, I found all this money. Clearly, this is somebody else's property. You turn it into police. Can you guys track it down? And then if they couldn't track it down, then the money would come to you.
Yeah.
But he'd already determined he wasn't going to contact the police. He was going to keep it, but unless he could figure out who the rightful owner is. And since he said he knew, he could figure out that house is just like four or five doors down. I walked by that house all the time. I'm going to ask them. If they had said no, he probably would have just kept it.
Ah, all right.
There you go.
And karma will be his reward.
Yeah, that's right. And he gets to be talked about in the Tom and Curly Show.
I hope good things happen for him.
Yeah.
What if something really horrible happens? Maybe he falls off the roof and breaks his back. You're like, what? I should have kept the money. All righty. Coming back with the fact that Seattle voters will maybe have an opportunity to vote on the jobs tax. We'll find out what is in store for the Seattle City Council. And how would you vote in November? Tom, how would you vote?
Oh, I think I know.
Okay. Well, I think everyone will just be shocked to find out your opinion on that.